2 days ago. I don't remember when Jenny was in playing Monopoly with the kids. Monopoly. Now, there's a game that the disciples understand. Monopoly is the most... It has sold more games than any other board game in the history of board games. I mean, the name of the game is competition, status, power. You want to rule the board. My oldest son started playing, but he quit. He quit in the middle of the game. In his words, "I was about to lose it on someone, Dad." I understand that. He probably stepped out because he didn't want to lose it on somebody, but the fact of the matter is he doesn't like to lose, and that's what he was doing. Now, I can relate to that. I remember I was thinking about this. My earliest field day memory, I was in a race. This was over at Farah. I can't remember if I was in kindergarten, first grade, but I was in a race, and I was so proud my dad was there. I was going to run the race. I was going to win. I was going to get the trophy. It was going to be wonderful. And we started out. Oh, this probably wasn't a gun. Not at field day anyway, but something. And I started running. And it became quickly apparent that I was not going to be first. I was not going to be second. And I was not going to be third. And so what did I do? I tripped. And I fell down. I told Dad, "Dad, did you see that I tripped?" I'm like, "Yes, son, that was really weird." I think he kind of knew. Because I thought, if I can't win, then I didn't want to finish. Because I know how to play that game. I know that drive. There's so much in my experience, my upbringing, that has nurtured this disposition to be first, to be on top. Leadership camps, leadership awards, scholarships, class offices, good grades, success in my endeavors, all the while that voice whispering to me, "Oh, you can be something great." That's James and John. I get James and John. Want to be bigger. Want to be better. Want to rule the board, win the race, advancement, entitlement, upward mobility. That's the American way, is it not? I want to be somebody. Better yet, I want to be somebody that other bodies want to be around. Or at least I want to be next to that somebody. Maybe on their right or on their left. We live in a culture that's fixated on greatness, that's fixated on leadership, the ladder of success, moving from the bottom to the top. I went on Amazon and did a simple search, Amazon books. I put in leadership and greatness. I got 900 hits. I put in leadership and servanthood. Got 153. And most of those were about servant leadership, a way of using service to get on top. We live in a culture that's fixated on greatness, on being on top. And it's not that that desire for authority is a bad thing or the desire to lead is a bad thing. It's actually not. If you've been in the Genesis class that we have been talking about, the adult class at 9 o'clock, you would know that the desire to rule, the desire for authority is God-given. The problem is that prerogative that God gives us is upended by my sin that wants to use that power not for other people's good, but for my good, my kingdom. Instead of being an ambassador for the king, I set up my own kingdom. Instead of wanting what's good for others, I want what's good for myself. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. And I look at God and I say, well, what's good for God must be good for me. And I reach out and I take that fruit, trusting that I know what's best. I know how life should operate. We live in that culture. We swim in a culture infatuated with leadership, power, ambition, status, privilege, upward mobility. Henry Nouwen is a Catholic priest, one who I have learned so much from. One of my favorite reads. He says, "The society in which we live suggests in countless ways that the way to go is up. Making it to the top, entering the limelight, breaking the record. That's what draws attention. That's what gets us on the front page. That's what offers us money, fame, reward. In this country of self-made pioneers, in which ambition is praised from the first moment we enter school until that competitive world of free enterprise, we cannot imagine any other good that can come from giving up power or not even desiring it." Like the disciples, James and John, I can identify with them. They have trouble imagining a different economy altogether where power, privilege, and status is not about who's on top. And then we meet Jesus who teaches that alternative upside down, inside out kingdom. You know, the Gospels actually have very little to say about leading. The verb lead is mentioned 21 times in the Gospels, and most of those are actually in negative contexts, like the one we read. You see how the Gentiles lord it over their subjects. But if you look for what the Gospels say about following, that verb occurs 86 times, and it's in mostly positive contexts. A large part of those are commands. Follow me. The Gospel is so much more about following than it ever is about leading. And so Jesus stokes our imagination of another way, a way conceptualized not first by leadership, but followership. A followership that redefines categories of power, of status, of privilege, of social distinction. See, life in God's kingdom is not about, first of all, about a strategy of leadership, but faithfulness of following. Deny yourself, Jesus says. Take up your cross and follow me. Life in the kingdom of God is not a contest for status, not a competition for comparison. It's not about who really gets the goods, who knows what's going on. When the disciples are arguing about such things, Jesus brings a child, a powerless, statusless, obscure child into their midst and says, if you want the kingdom, you got to learn how to receive the kingdom like this child. Life in the kingdom doesn't need riches, doesn't need fame, doesn't need privilege. In fact, when that shows up, it shows up in chapter 10 in the face of a rich young ruler. The disciples, you can hear their excitement. I mean, this guy's got it together. He's rich. He's young. He's got the goods. And he's even pious. I mean, this is the guy we want. Let's hire him as our minister. Let's get this guy in. We want him on the roll to lead us. But when Jesus looks at him, he doesn't see salary. He sees slavery. And he says, go, sell all you have, give it to the poor, and come follow me. And then Jesus lets that man walk away because he knows that that is the only way for that man to enter the kingdom. Life in the kingdom is not about ruling over. It's not about authority over. It's not about pulling rank on each other. That's what the Gentiles do, Jesus tells them. Not so with you. Not so with you, He tells His disciples. You want greatness? Then get low. You want esteem? Then be a servant. You want to be first? Then bicker over the back of the line. The imagination of Jesus confronts the disciples all along the way to imagine a different way, a way defined not by the crowns but by the cross, not by control but by children, not by self-reliance but by dependence, not by status but by service. It's the way of downward mobility. Downward mobility. I first learned that term from Henry Nouwen. Christians are called to divest themselves, to be downwardly mobile. Nouwen, I mentioned, he's dead now, died in the first part of this century, but was a Catholic priest. He preached at those little-known schools called Notre Dame and Harvard and Yale. You probably haven't heard of those. No, he was on the upward path. He was doing quite well for himself. But then he met Jean Vanier, who is the founder of L'Arche Communities. Communities that are made up of handicapped people and their assistants. And Vanier came to him one day and said, "Henry, you need to come to our community. You need to be with us." Not, "Henry, you need to work with us." Not, "Henry, you need to come lecture for us." But, "Henry, you need to come and you need to be with us." And Nouwen relates in several places he heard that call and he wrestled with that call and finally decided that that was the call of God on his life. And so for the next season of his life, he went and stayed at Daybreak, a L'Arche community of 100 people, made up of 50 handicapped folk and 50 of their assistants in Toronto. And on the first day, Henry met Adam. Adam was a 24-year-old man, completely handicapped, couldn't speak, he couldn't dress himself, he couldn't bathe himself. He was barely responsive. And Henry became Adam's assistant, carrying him from his bed to the bath, bathing him, combing his hair, dressing him, feeding him, all of which took excruciating long periods of time. This was a guy that not too long ago was teaching in the great universities of America. And as Henry reflected on those times, at first, he says, "I was afraid to be in such close proximity, such close touch." But slowly, over time, Henry says, he learned that God was speaking through him, through this broken man to him, of a new way of life. A way of worth that wasn't dependent on what you did, but on who you were. A child of God. A way of worth that spoke of your being, not just your doing. A way that valued much more giving than it did taking. A way that treasured and lifted up vulnerability and powerlessness to teach the right use of strength and authority in the exercise of loving community. Henry says, and here I quote Nouwen, "My whole life I had been surrounded by well-meaning encouragement to go higher up. And the most used argument was, 'You can do so much good there for so many people.' But these voices calling me to upward mobility are completely absent from the gospel." The story of salvation stands radically over and against the philosophy of upward mobility. The great paradox of Scripture reveals to us that real and total freedom is found only through downward mobility. The Word of God came to us and lived among us as a slave. The divine way is indeed the downward way. This is what Jesus tries to communicate to His disciples on the way to Jerusalem, where they think He is going to seize power, but where He knows He will be nailed to a cross. As I was thinking about this sermon, it struck me, you know, this congregation is trying to hire its next preacher. It's in the process of looking at candidates. But this servant emphasis, I think it's pretty important. And it might behoove us to ask these candidates as they come in. So just take a minute and imagine yourself that you are the committee surveying the candidate. And we've liked what we've heard from this one particular candidate so far. The initial interview has gone great, but now it's down to brass tacks. This is the time we get to sit and ask some hard questions. So one of you, remembering a sermon that your interim minister taught some time ago, thought, I might ask this person about what it means to be a servant. How have you demonstrated God's call to be a servant in your life? Good question. The candidate sits back, takes a long moment of reflection. He says, well, you know what? My first job at a church, I got this internship at this well-known preacher, big congregation. I was so excited. Of course, I couldn't help thinking I was kind of something special to get the internship. And I went that first day, and he met me at the door. I thought that was so cool. He came out, he met me. And he said, I have a job for you. I thought, great, we're going to dig right into it. Who can I pray for? What sermon can I preach? What class can I teach? Who can I visit? And he took me inside and he showed me a bucket and some cleaning supplies. And he said, our building has 10 bathrooms. I want you to spend the day cleaning every bathroom, and then after you're done, come talk to me. At first, I was just astounded. And then I grew mad. And then as I was cleaning all the bathrooms, it began to dawn on me what he was trying to teach me. And I came back later and talked with him, and he said, you've learned your first lesson of ministry, that if you want to serve the church, then you must be willing to serve the church in whatever capacity they ask you to serve. And he says, you know, that experience taught me so much about what it means to be a servant, what the call of ministry is. You know, at that time, the committee, we're all looking around ourselves going, this is good. This guy's good. But he goes on. He says, you know, I know that in my marriage has been a constant opportunity for me to learn what it means to serve. The dirty dishes pile up, the laundry piles up, cleaning needs to be done. And I struggle. I want to go sit in my chair and read. I'm looking at my wife. But what those opportunities represent, he says, are opportunities to say no to my desires and yes to the call to be a servant. He says, I also have some regular practices that I like to engage in ministry. He says, every so often, we have lots of kids that are service, our building. And every so often, I'll just go in and I'll sit down and I'll play with the kids. No agenda. But I take seriously Jesus' call to say that if you want to receive the kingdom, you got to receive it like a child. And so I think that's a pretty important thing that I do. But I also want to make it a point to visit those who would not otherwise ever be able to visit me, the sick and the shut-ins. But I like to make a regular visit to our local jails here, too. this point. The committee, I mean, we think we got Jesus on our hands here. This is great. But no, he's not done. He says, you know, probably the most important thing that I do, though, is once a month I take some time away to listen to who I am in God's eyes, because this is what I've learned about my life. I've learned that if I don't listen to the voice of God, I open myself up to serve because of either manipulation or because I'm trying to earn the praises of those that I serve. So that's real important that I take that time away. I can see Bob Holder in the back. He's like, hire this guy now. Let's do it. I mean, we think we've struck gold. And we're ready. But he says, you know, the call of service is important. And I'm interested in working with a church that understands this call of service. So would you mind if I ask you a few questions? Okay. I'm interested in knowing how you speak about one another when those others aren't around. How would you characterize your speech about other people? Do you serve each other in your conversations, even when those others don't know you're speaking about them? Can you give me an example or two of the way your church, your members, are embracing the little people, the vulnerable, the unsophisticated in your community? If your church were shut down tomorrow, who would notice in your community that it's gone? Would it be only the insiders, those that show up? Or would outsiders mourn your disappearance? And my last question. Can you tell me about your last church conflict? How would you characterize your handling of that disagreement? Did your disagreement, which every congregation is bound to have, did you evidence the call to serve one another, to submit to one another? Or were you more like the disciples, jockeying for position? James and John didn't have it right. But they were asking the right person. They believed that Jesus would come into His glory and they wanted to be near Him. What they didn't understand is that glory meant that they would have to rub shoulders with the least, the dishonorable, the fragile, on the downward path of servanthood. We too this morning in our service have proclaimed the desire to be near Christ. We want Christ to come and be near us. But Christ says this morning that if you want to come near, if you want to follow me, then come. Come. But I'm down here. Come. Follow. But I'm down here. I'm down here. Come down. Be a servant. And there I will be with you. Let us stand and sing.